We're going to look this morning at a story of three women. Not to be confused for one minute with that terrible book written by Charles Dickens called The Tale of Two Cities. Worst book I've ever read, and that's saying something. But anyway, there you go. We're going to look at the stories of three women. And I suppose my starting motivation is simply because if you read the Bible, you sometimes get the idea it's all the stories of men. But actually, as we're going to see with these three women, we get an incredible amount of detail about these people, which is uncommon in the Gospels. So we're going to start with Mary Magdalene. Okay, so what do we know about her? Well, Matthew chapter 15, which is still fairly early on in Jesus' ministry, says, after Jesus had sent the crowd away, this is verse 39, after Jesus had sent the crowd away, he got into the boat and went to the vicinity of Magadan, which scholars agree is the same as Magdala. It's on the shore of the lake. There are two different places called Magdala. This one is known as Magdala of the Fishers, because you can guess what everyone who lived there did for a living, okay? And so we assume that it's this visit to Magdalene, Magdala, that Jesus met Mary, who, Luke tells us, was demon-possessed. If you look at Luke chapter 8 and verse 2, it mentions the following, that some women who've been cured of evil spirits and diseases, Mary, called Magdalene, from whom seven demons had come out. Okay, we don't know much else about Mary in terms of her background or anything. There is a tradition that she was a widow, and you'll see why that might make sense in a moment. But just let's pause for a minute and think about these seven demons. There are two possible explanations of what that means. One explanation is they were literally seven demons. Count them coming out. 1, 2, 3, 6, 7, okay? Could be, but another possible explanation is the seven, being in Jewish thinking, the number meaning totality, completeness, simply means every aspect of this woman's life was controlled and managed by this demon possession. And I'd like you to think for a minute about what that would have meant to Mary. So keep your finger there in Luke chapter 8, if you've got it, and go back to Mark chapter 5, where there's another story about someone who had a multiple demon possession and what it meant for that person. First one, they went across the lake to the region of the Gerasenes. When Jesus got out of the boat, a man with an evil spirit came from the tomb to meet him. Now notice the description of this man's condition. This man lived in the tombs. No one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain, for he'd often been chained hand and foot, but he tore the chains apart and broke the irons on his feet. No one was strong enough to subdue him. Night and day among the tombs and in the hills, he would cry out and cut himself with stones. Okay? Now we know how that story ends. We know that Jesus cast the demons out of him. We know it was demon possession because Jesus actually has a conversation with the demon, which is kind of scary, but there you go. So notice these characteristics of multiple demon possession. Number one, this person becomes an outcast from society. They're living homeless, they're on the street, or in this case, not even on the street, they're outside the town living in the old cemetery. Second, they're tormented night and day, roaming around the hills and between the tombs, crying out in anguish, okay? There's a loss of dignity. We find out that when Jesus has healed this person, people comment on the fact, wow, he's now dressed. So clearly prior to that, he wasn't. He was running around naked, okay? And lastly, that he had superhuman strength. Couldn't be bound, couldn't be subdued. I would suspect that if that was the characteristics of the demon, or demons, that inhabited this man, I suspect that was the condition Mary Magdalene was in as well. Multiple demon possession. Bound to be pretty similar, okay? So when Jesus sets her free from those demons, going back to Luke chapter 8, verse 2, we find something quite interesting happening. Sorry, verse 3 actually. So it mentions these women, and there's more. I mean, we could tell their stories as well, but we're not going to this morning. Mary Magdalene, from whom seven demons had come out, Joanna, the wife of Chusa, manager of Herod's household, Susanna, and many others. Notice that, it's quite important. These women were helping to support them, that is, Jesus and his disciples, out of their own means. So Mary Magdalene, having been cured of this demon possession, then becomes a follower of Jesus, and she brings her bank account with her, and she provides for Jesus and his disciples as they go on. And that's where the idea comes from, that possibly she was a wealthy widow. Of course, Mary Magdalene was also there at the cross, and Mary Magdalene was also the first person Jesus spoke to after the resurrection, which is why the Catholic Church refers to her as the disciple of disciples. And we'll come back to this thought later on, but it's interesting that specifically mentioned as being there at the cross were mostly women. The disciples were elsewhere, they'd run away, but the women were there. And when it comes to the resurrection, who's there first? Mary Magdalene and the other Mary. The disciples are still hiding away, terrified, but they come out and they go to the tomb. Okay, so that's the story of Mary Magdalene, and that's pretty much all we know about her. Now the next person we're going to look at is also called Mary. I should mention, that's no big deal, there are lots of Marys. Four of them are specifically mentioned by name in the Gospels. Apparently it's a common name. So let's turn over to Luke chapter 10, and let's look at the story of this Mary. Verse 38. As Jesus and his disciples were on their way, he came to a village where a woman named Martha opened her home to him. She had a sister called Mary, who sat at the Lord's feet listening to what he said. But Martha was distracted by all the preparations that had to be made. She came to him and asked, "Lord, don't you care that my sister has left me to do the work by myself? Tell her to help me." "Martha, Martha," the Lord answered, "you're worried and upset about many things, but only one thing is needed. Mary has chosen what is better, and it will not be taken away from her." From this one story, we can actually deduce quite a lot about Mary's character. First of all, about three, Mary, Martha, and Lazarus, we can guess that they're probably around Jesus' own age, so 30-ish, okay? Because they seem to become friends, rather than just disciples or followers, they've become friends of Jesus. We can also surmise that none of the three is married, probably. Because if Martha were married, this wouldn't be Martha's house, it would be named by her husband. And Lazarus, well, why would Lazarus be there if he had a wife of his own somewhere else? And why would Mary be living with Big Sister if she were married? So we can surmise that all three were unmarried. We can also tell a little bit about Mary's character, because she is committing two terribly antisocial acts in this scene. Did you spot them? First of all, culturally, a woman's place was in the kitchen, preparing for the guests. So for Mary to abandon that was a bit, well, lack of etiquette, shall we say. But the next one was almost worse. Notice where she ends up, sitting on the floor at Jesus' feet in the posture of a disciple. And a woman had no right taking the role of a disciple. That place there at the rabbi's feet was reserved for a young disciple who would, of course, be a boy. So Mary's a little bit socially inept at best, shall we say, okay? Or she's a bit ignorant of what's expected of her, or she's just so strongly motivated she doesn't care. But either which way, we see a woman who clearly cares a lot about her relationship with Jesus and isn't bothered what anyone thinks of her. Notice that the next time she comes up is later on in things, when Lazarus dies, and she, along with her sister, rely on Jesus, go to Jesus and say, "If you'd been here when my brother was sick, he wouldn't have died." And of course, they enter into that dialogue. And so they're there when Lazarus is raised from the dead, and so on. But that is pretty much all we know about Mary of Bethany. Okay, so let's move on to our third woman, who we will find in John chapter 8. Now, first of all, this is quite interesting, because this bit isn't actually in John's Gospel. But, well, it is, but it isn't. And it's worth just taking a moment to explain what happened there. If you have an older version of the Bible, John chapter 8, verse 1 through to 11 is simply in the body of the text. But if you have a slightly more modern translation, it will either put it in italics or it will put a line above and a line below and so on. Because what's happened is, as people translate the Bible, scholarship has got better and archaeology has got better, and we have more and more older and older documents. Well, clearly, the closer we can go back to the original autograph, which we don't have John's original writing of John's Gospel, but the closer we can go back to that, the more authentic our document would be. And this story isn't in the most original authentic documents. Somehow it got included. I suspect probably what happened was someone had a Gospel of John. Maybe this story was even written down by John, and so somebody put the two together on the shelf. And then a scribe came along and said, hey, do you mind if I copy your Gospel of John? Go ahead, help yourself. So he sits down, starts writing, turns over the page. Oh, what's this? I'll copy it anyway. And so it gets included in the next version of John's Gospel. So by the fact that it's not in the original Gospel, doesn't imply either that it's not true, or that maybe even John didn't write it himself. It's just not there in your most authentic copy of John's Gospel. However, this story has such a ring of truth about it that every version of the Bible still includes it, because it just tells us so much about the way that grace and the Gospel work. So the story basically is this. Jesus went into the temple court to teach. That's an important point we'll come back to later. And all of a sudden there's a commotion, and in come these Pharisees and teachers of the law, and they drag in this woman and made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, teacher, we caught her in the very act of adultery. Okay. The woman's not named, but in actual fact, that's probably simply because she was just collateral damage. She was incidental. She didn't matter. All they were trying to do was trap Jesus. And we know what the trap is. Basically, if Jesus was going to uphold the law of Moses, he'd have to say, yeah, take her outside and stone her. In which case, the religious leaders would go running straight off to the Romans, because when we come to Jesus' own crucifixion, we realise the Jews, as an occupied territory, had no right to enact the death penalty. So if Jesus had said, yeah, take her out and stone her, she's guilty, then they would have gone running off to the Romans and said, hey, this guy's taken the law into his own hands, and Jesus would have been strung up the same day. If, on the other hand, Jesus said, well, we can't execute her, so let her off, they'd go running to the people and say, here's this so-called rabbi, but he doesn't even want to keep the law of Moses either which way. They thought they couldn't lose. So the woman, as I said, is just collateral damage. She's incidental. By the way, have you ever wondered where the man was?
Yeah.
Well, I read an interesting explanation of that. Let me try and get this right. In terms of a legal court, you have to have an accuser. So if a woman commits adultery, it's the wife of the man of whom she commits adultery that has to bring the charge in the court. That making sense?
Yeah.
So if this woman, as has been suggested, is in fact a prostitute rather than a married woman, there's no one to bring the charge against the man, because this woman doesn't have a husband to bring the charge against the other man. Does that sort of make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So it's one possible explanation. It could just be that the Pharisees were just, you know, their idea of how the law worked was very convenient to their idea of how the law worked, wasn't it? So it could just be that they were just, you know, letting the guy go. Could even be it was set up, who knows? There is also, of course, the suggestion that this woman was a prostitute, because how can you make sure that Jesus is here and there's a crowd here and there's a victim ready here unless you know where to find a suitable victim at that hour of the morning? So there's a possibility they knew exactly where this woman plied her trade, and so they just went and fetched her. All right, okay. However, we know what Jesus did with it. End of verse 6. Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger. When they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, if any one of you is without sin, let him be the first to throw a stone at her. And he stooped down and wrote on the ground again. At this, those who heard began to go away one at a time, the old ones first. I suspect that Jesus wrote names and places and dates that jogged the memory of those self-righteous Pharisees. They weren't quite as innocent as they were pretending to be. And so he was able to turn around to this woman and say, where are the ones who would condemn you? There's no one here, so she said. Then neither do I condemn you, Jesus declared. And it's that really which is sort of the core of the gospel understanding, isn't it? It's not that we haven't done something wrong. It's just that God sets in place a way by which we can't be condemned for it. Okay. So, three stories, three women. Now, here we get to the interesting part of the story. Because even as I've been telling you this, you may have been thinking to yourself, but hang on, I thought the woman caught in adultery was Mary Magdalene. And I thought maybe that the other Mary was also Mary Magdalene. And I thought that, in actual fact, these three women were actually just one woman. Well, the interesting thing about this tradition is we know exactly who started it and when. In 591, AD 591, Pope Gregory, seeking to address the fascinating question of who was this woman, wrote a homily in which he suggested that actually both Marys and the prostitute were the same person. Now notice, this wasn't like a papal writ, this wasn't claiming infallibility, it was just a little article he wrote, a homily. And it's become tradition. And everyone takes it for granted these days that, yeah, they're the same person, all right? Now, actually, I think I've already given you enough information this morning to help you see there's no way those are the same women. No way, they're three separate people, obviously. Okay? But just in case you missed it, let's go through it. Number one, Mary Magdalene is consistently referred to as Mary Magdalene, whereas the other Mary is referred to as Mary. Mary, the mother of Jesus, is consistently referred to as Mary, the mother of Jesus. The fourth Mary mentioned in the Gospel, Mary the wife of Cleopas, is referred to as Mary the wife of Cleopas. They're different people. If they were the same person, there'd be some confusion. All right, but there isn't. So linguistically, in the text, we find that they're all, four of them are identified by the text. Okay. Next thing, let's think about location. Magdala is over on one side of the lake. Bethany is near Jerusalem on the other side of the lake, and the woman caught in adultery, that happened in Jerusalem. One can be assumed they didn't drag her all the way from some village miles outside of town to the temple courts that morning. There was probably an adulterous woman nearby they could grab hold of. So the location would suggest that, again, they're separate people, they're different. Next, let's think about timeline. Mary Magdalene was healed of her seven demons at the beginning of Jesus' ministry. She then continues, so try and imagine this timeline. I wish I had a blackboard at this stage, but there you go. Imagine this timeline, then Mary becomes a disciple. She follows Jesus around, providing for him. She's there at the cross, she's there at the tomb. So throughout this whole of this timeline, Mary Magdalene is a follower of Jesus. Now, to keep that timeline start point, somewhere in the middle we find Mary of Bethany at Jesus' feet, listening to him as a disciple. We then come across her at Lazarus being raised from the dead, which is quite late in Jesus' ministry, and then possibly we find her there at the cross again. So these, you know, the timelines wouldn't work. And this woman who is a prostitute, that happens probably during the last week of Jesus' ministry. The clues are, number one, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law know they can find Jesus in the temple court. Well, Jesus was all over the place throughout his ministry. But as he draws towards the end of his ministry, he increasingly spends time in the temple courts. Furthermore, it's towards the end of his ministry that the Pharisees are desperate to stitch him up for something and get rid of him. And if you read Matthew's account of it, you just see this escalating sequence of Pharisees trying to trap Jesus and Jesus getting really in their face in terms of how he describes them. And this happens towards the end of his ministry. So the chances are that this scene that John records in John chapter 8 takes place during the last week of Jesus' ministry. The earliest any commentator will put it is 6 months before the end of Jesus' ministry. So think that through, timeline. Mary Magdalene is healed here, is a disciple throughout. Mary of Bethany is a disciple throughout. And right over here at the end, we have a prostitute being caught in the act. So are we suggesting that Mary Magdalene, who's healed, who becomes a follower all the way through, but now she's an active prostitute? Nah. It just doesn't hold together. And then there's one more clue, which is one of the links that's always been made is, aha, this Mary who has these seven demons, she must have got seven demons by being a prostitute. Okay, let's just think this through, gentlemen. Okay? This is a lady who has no dignity, who runs around the place naked. She lives among the tombs, crying out because she's tormented day and night. She has superhuman strength. Is anything I've just said making you attracted to this lady as a person of negotiable affection? Not so much. It just doesn't work, okay? Right, there is, however, one more story I deliberately haven't mentioned, which could be a connection. And it's found in all four Gospels, but I'll sort of tell the composite story of it. There was a man called Simon the Pharisee. One of the other Gospels calls him Simon the Leper. So clearly, patch these together, we have a Pharisee who gets leprosy, but then Jesus heals him. As a consequence of that healing, he now throws a feast and invites all the nice people of the neighbourhood, including Jesus and his disciples, to the feast. Okay. Halfway through this feast, in comes a woman. One of the Gospel accounts says it was Mary, and the place was Bethany. So there are some clues there as to who it was. And this is where it gets interesting, because this woman brings a bottle of very valuable perfume with her. In modern terms, probably about £20,000 worth of perfume. And she opens this bottle, pours it over Jesus' head, and then she ends up on the floor at Jesus' feet, weeping, wetting his feet with her tears, drying them with her long hair. Naturally, everyone is horrified. What a scene, what a disturbance. Most people comment on the value of the perfume and what a waste it was to pour that out like that. But one man, Simon, the host, tells a different story. He says, if this Jesus were really a prophet, he'd know what kind of woman is touching him, because she's a sinful woman. Okay. So people have taken this account and have said, aha, you see, this is Mary. And she's a sinful woman, therefore she must be a prostitute. And she's got expensive perfume, and that goes with the job of being a prostitute. Except that when you really, really, really think about it more carefully, it just doesn't add up. So let's play detective for a second. First of all, where's this? Bethany. Who is the woman? Mary. Not Mary Magdalene. Mary. Okay, so we know which Mary it was. It's pretty obvious. Second, the bottle is unopened before the feast. One of the gospel accounts says she broke the bottle to open it. Another one says it was a full measure, a full pint. Well, how would you know if it was a full pint if the bottle was half empty? So this wasn't perfume that Mary was using. It was perfume that she was keeping to store her wealth. You see, even today in this society, there are people who don't trust banks. Can't imagine why. So when they get some extra money, they buy the wife some more jewellery. I think you probably know which kind of group of people I'm talking about. And when they need a new caravan, the wife sells some jewellery. And that's their bank. So if, as we surmised, Mary, Martha and Lazarus are orphans, it's a very good chance their parents left them something of value. One of them got the house, one of them got something else, and Mary gets a dowry, a bank account. This very, very valuable bottle of perfume, which she stores carefully, unopened, on a shelf, until she has need of it. So what Mary's doing here is pouring out her life savings on Jesus. Interesting, okay? What about this business of her being... one more point. Notice where she ends up, at Jesus' feet, which Mary, have we seen already, has this habit of ending up at Jesus' feet on the floor. Okay, so it's clearly the same Mary that we've talked about previously. Okay, what about this business of Simon saying that Mary was a sinful woman? Well, first of all, he was a Pharisee, she was a woman. That would be enough. It's not recorded in Scripture, but it is known that Pharisees prayed a prayer, "Oh God, I thank you that I was neither born a woman nor a Gentile." That was their attitude to women. So the mere fact that she was a woman would have been enough for Simon to say, "Why is he letting her touch him?" Okay. But then notice the story that Jesus tells in response and listen carefully to what he's saying. He says, "Simon, I've got something to tell you. Once upon a time, there were two men who had debts. One had a big debt, one had a small debt. Both had their debts cancelled. Who do you think was more grateful?" And Simon sort of mutters, "Well, I suppose the one who's forgiven more." And Jesus says, "Yes, yet when I came into your house, you didn't even give me water to wash my feet." Who's the one with the bigger debt? Him. And when you think about it, it comes up perfectly, because Simon had been a leper, an outcast from society, unable to see his family or meet his friends, losing his dignity as the disease eroded his face, his nose, his ears, his lips. A horrible, horrible disease, a terrible state to be in. And the Jews believed that all sickness was the consequence of sin. Right? So who is the man who had the bigger debt? Simon. And Jesus turning of that into, "Yet when I came into your house, you didn't even give me water to wash my feet. But this woman, who's the smaller debtor, she has never ceased from washing my feet with her tears." It's a powerful story because it's contrasting the one with the other. The one who had the bigger debt with showing no gratitude, and the one who had the smaller debt with showing immense gratitude. So, I think when we actually start to look at the evidence, we would have to say, no, these three women are not the same. However, they do have a very, very common thing, which is that all three of them undoubtedly committed their lives to following Jesus because of what Jesus had done for them. And that's a thought we'll come back to in a minute. Okay, so three teaching points. First of all, we need to be very, very careful about tradition. And please don't think for 1 minute that we're immune to it. Conservative Christians are the worst for getting tied up in traditions. They really are, okay? And if we have a little more time, I'd give you an example from looking at the way the King James Version of the Bible, which of course, as all conservative Christians know, is the only one that's any good. Just how bad it is, and I'll show you some of the mistakes and flaws and errors in the translation, just to illustrate the point that isn't it interesting how the tradition grows up? We've got to read the King James, or we can't get true doctrine from any of the Bible. But when you really look at the evidence, that argument falls apart. So we've got to make sure that our belief and our behaviour as well is evidence-based rather than tradition-driven. The second point to bring out of this is that we shouldn't judge. Okay? Now Simon jumped in to judge this woman. Oh, she's a sinful woman. But of course the truth of it is that we're all on a spiritual journey. And so we should never look at other people and feel superior to them, which, again, is so easy to do, because if we've moved further along that spiritual journey, we look back at something, someone who has perhaps some kind of habit or something that we've given up, and we say, well, I'm better than that because I quit. Have you ever spoken to anyone who quit smoking? Mm-hmm. They're not very nice about people who still smoke, are they? Right, now the same sort of thing can tend to happen within a spiritual sense. We look back at what someone else is doing and we say, well, why don't they just stop doing it? Because I've stopped doing it. I've moved on. Why don't they move on? Well, okay. We shouldn't judge. What we should be is grateful. And even if Simon's allegation was the other way around, even if Mary was guilty of something horrible, all that should do is make us more grateful because we've been forgiven more. Our debt has been cancelled. Okay. Now, that doesn't mean that we should tolerate sin within the church. For example, remember when Jesus spoke to the Samaritan woman? And, you know, it's a beautiful story of grace, it's about acceptance, it's about true worship, it's about spirit. But Jesus begins with challenging her and her lifestyle, saying, you've had five husbands and the one you're with isn't even your husband, go sort yourself out. So it's not that we shouldn't challenge sin, but we shouldn't judge other people. Okay, the third sort of teaching point or lesson I'd like to draw from this is as follows. When Jesus finished speaking to the woman, possibly a prostitute, who was about to be lynched, he said, neither do I condemn you. Now go and leave your life of sin. You see, the Christian message of salvation and forgiveness and so on is a two-faced message. One face looks backward, and it looks back at what we have done in the past and what we were in the past. And it tells us that's gone. It's forgiven. Both Old Testament and New repeatedly refer to this idea that when we ask for forgiveness, God forgets our sins. It talks about them being buried in the depths of the sea. Again and again, God says, I will remember them no more. Okay? We have sometimes had this idea that everything that's ever happened is all recorded in a book somewhere. It's all going to come back to haunt us. God says, no, it's gone. Even God forgets them once they're forgiven. So the past is indeed a foreign country, and we don't live there anymore. But then the other part of that process is the forward-looking face. The face that looks to the future and says, I'm not going to do that again. I'm not going to go back into that situation again. And this example here that we're given in John 8 is actually a really, really good one, isn't it? Because there are some sins or wrongdoing which we don't intend to do but which we kind of fall into. So let's say you set out in the morning and you think to yourself, I'm not going to use any bad language today. I'm not going to use any bad language today. And the first thing you do at work is take your thumb with a hammer. Out comes a wood. Yeah? So you've set out with the right intentions but you've slipped up. Now by comparison, I've never heard of anyone who went round the corner shop for a pint of milk and ended up climbing out of a strange woman's bed. Adultery is something which you kind of ease yourself into over a period of time. You meet someone, you like them, go out of your way, spend time with them. You begin to create a web of lies for the person you're leaving behind. You eventually build such a deception that you end up in bed with that person. That's not an accident, that's a deliberate series of decisions you've taken. And it's those kind of sins which Jesus says to the woman, stop doing it. Just stop it. No excuses, stop it. Okay? We are sinful. We're going to keep on messing up. We're going to keep on hitting our thumbs with a hammer and saying something we shouldn't say. We're going to keep on, I don't know, saying hurtful things when we never intended to. But what we've got to do is repent. Because repentance is often mentioned as looking backwards, but actually it means to turn again, turn away from, going back into that same mud pool over and over and over again. And that really is the message we should get out of this story of the woman caught in adultery. So just some more things up quickly. One, we need to be very, very cautious about tradition, very careful, so easy for them to arise and become a part of what we do. Secondly, beware of judgmental attitudes. Really careful, it's so easy to judge other people by thinking that we're better at them. But lastly, it's a challenge for each of us. Is there any aspect of our lives that the Holy Spirit is challenging us with the same message Jesus gave to that woman, to go and sin no more?